groups and write down perhaps a challenging question or two your students have posed to you or one of your own. And when I got those back, I quickly typed them up, drew a couple of diagrams in there, so you guys threw some diagrams on there. And we had a total of 31 questions. Now, Sean Gribb here and Drew Bansel, you'll be here in a moment, have been kind enough to donate their time today to come on in and answer, unfortunately, not all the questions, but ones that pique their interest and will hopefully be able to give you a decent explanation on. So I'm going to start off by turning it over to Sean Gribb. And Sean, I just want to tell a little bit about yourself and what you're doing here and the research that you're doing, and I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. So I'm just a freshman, my PhD here at Perimeter Institute. And I do string theory, so I just sort of started my research project. My supervisor is Rob Myers, one of the string theorists working here. So that's basically what I'm doing. Is that all you want?
Yeah, that's
cool. Okay. So I took a look at, there's a huge list of questions, and they're all very good, but I only have like 5 minutes, or like 10 minutes or something, or 5 minutes per question. So I try to find things that I could hopefully answer quickly, and completely, but hopefully questions that led to something else, so, or something deep. So, okay. So here are two of the questions that I was going to answer. First one is, the question was, what is the difference between spin up and spin down? And then, what is the difference between half integer and full integer spin? So basically, what I interpret this as, what is spin? And so hopefully I can give like a very brief description of what that is. And actually, it's probably, spin is people talk about it as like this quantum mechanical thing, but really you can think of it classically too. Let me just before talking about spin, I'll try to talk about things that maybe you do understand. This is going to be good. Okay. So the first thing, spin is something that you attribute to what's called a spinner field. But before I talk about what a spinner field actually is, talk about something that you might be familiar with, which is a vector field. So like, this is just something that you may learn. This is a point charge Q or something, so positive Q. And so at every point, you have this vector field E, the electric field, okay, coming out. And it's just a vector at every point in space. So I can use basically Coulomb's law to figure out like what the magnitude of the vector is and what direction it points in itself. But that's a vector field. It's just something that exists at every point in space, and it has three components. All right. The important thing about a vector field is that it has certain symmetry laws. So if you take a vector, and this is an ugly diagram, but if you just think of a vector that's hockey stick, right, and then we rotate it in three-dimensional space, the vector doesn't change, its length stays the same. All right, that's a very important property, and it seems obvious to most people, but mathematically that's really important. The other thing is that if you just take this vector, like I have here, you have some space, some coordinate, three-dimensional coordinate system, and then you rotate the coordinate system, right? Or you could think of it just rotating the vector in this space. The vector doesn't really know what's happening. It can't tell that it's being rotated, right? So because there's nothing else in the space except for this vector, when it rotates, it doesn't know that it's like nothing physical is happening to it, all right? And so that's like a symmetry. It's a rotational symmetry of the vector. It's three-dimensional. Okay. And so I think I've already probably almost belabored this point. So it has these symmetry properties, and also it's three-dimensional, which means that you can take the vector and you can write it out in terms of three basis vectors. Okay? So if you have this vector, you can write it in terms of the
E times the basis vector I, j, k. This is something that you guys are probably familiar with here, right? So the basis vectors here are these I pointing the x, j pointing the y, k pointing the z. So that's what you really mean by something that's three-dimensional, is that you can take, you can write it in terms of these three basis vectors. Alright? So far this is all something that you guys are totally familiar with. Now the thing is that you can have different types of fields. So this is just one example, a vector field. But you can also have you can have scalar field, all right? So an example of a scalar field is the electric potential. So this is, again, probably something that you may be familiar with. Instead of a vector, it's just like, at every point in space, it has one value, right? It doesn't have three values, it just has one, okay? And the same thing, it has all these symmetry properties. It's just a point, right? And it has a value at some point. So if you rotate your space, you can do all kinds of stuff, and nothing, it's not going to change anything, right? So the vector field is a quantity that is symmetric under rotations, and it's three-dimensional. The scalar field is a quantity that is symmetric under rotations, but it's one-dimensional, okay? So hopefully you are starting to get an idea of where I'm going with this. And I'll try to cover this stuff. Okay, so again, you have like, you can think of it just as like this field 5 that has one basis vector, okay? And it's only one dimensional, so it's like a line, right? And then you just multiply some number by the basis vector and you get the value of the scalar field, right? It's all seems very simple. So this is three-dimensional, this is one-dimensional. And now the question is, can you produce a field, okay, that has two components, so it's two-dimensional, but it also has these same symmetry properties, that when you make rotations, it's symmetric under rotations, okay? And that's what a spinner field is, all right? So it's just like these things that we're totally used to dealing with, vectors and scalars, but it's slightly more general, and it's a spinner field. So, like in here we had space x, y, and z. Here we had some weird space. But in the spinner field, we have up and down components, right? And they're just like, you can think of them as sort of like the basis vectors of this two-dimensional space, okay? That the vector field, that the field lives in, all right? So that's basically what it is. And then in quantum mechanics, we interpret the value of the components as being like the probability of the field being in the up or down state. But you see, so like people talk about like these images about these spinning tops and it's spinning up or spinning down. But really these are just images, and the word spin is sort of unfortunate. It's an analogy that we try to use. But the reality is that they're just two components of a spinner field, a field that has two things. So now I'm going to go backwards somewhat and just show you an example. So an example would just be a non-relativistic electron is a spinner field. It's a quantity that at every point it has two components, right? And the components are up or down. And what it tells you, quantum mechanical interpretation of that is that it tells you if you make a measurement of this electron, will it be at this point? Will it be in an up state or a down state? And okay, so that's basically the difference between up and down. And then the second part of the question was, is this part. What is the difference between half and full integer spin? And the idea is that, so we have vectors, and they're three-dimensional. So it turns out that in mathematics, which is math, like groups of integral group theory, and it's a set of mathematical rules that you use to study fields that have different symmetry properties.
So the symmetry properties that we're talking about are rotations, all right? And it just turns out that they use numbers to sort of label the different types of fields you can have, right? And for these type of groups, the number is J, all right? And the dimension of the field, of the representation of the group is just given by 2J plus 1. So if we have a vector that's three-dimensional, J is going to be equal to 1, right? And 1 is an integer, all right? So for a scalar, the dimension is 1, and that just means that J has to be 0. So it has J equals 0. So here J is 1, for vector J is 1, for a scalar J is 0. And for a spinner, the dimension is 2, so that means that J has to be a half, because a half times 2 is 1 plus 1. Right? So the idea is that these sort of J's just label the types of fields that you have. So J equal a half is a spinner, J equals 0 scalar, J equals 1 is a vector. And it turns out that's what they mean. So this is an integer, this is an integer, this is a half integer, right? And these different types of fields have different properties, okay? So you kind of like intuitively, you have a vector field. So this is like the electric field, right? And then spinners are like electrons. So electric fields and electrons are different. An electron, you can think of it constituting matter, right? Whereas like electric fields are like fields are like forces, right? So it turns out that's the difference. This half versus a full integer. All right. So I guess we could talk about other.
Yeah.
I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. But the electron's magnetic moment is due to spin. Like, what's the connection?
So the electron has. Okay, so these spinner fields have all kinds of properties when you look at how they interact with electric fields, for example. And it turns out that, because they have this spin property called spin, they produce something that looks like a magnetic moment, right? And so, I mean, it is a magnetic moment of the electron. And that was actually where the word spin sort of came from, almost as an analogy, because we just noticed that the electron has a magnetic moment. And so we said, well, it must just be like some point that's spinning, like the top, right? But really, like, it can't be that way, because it would have to be spinning so quickly, or if it was, but really we like to think of it as maybe a point particle, so it could be spinning. So that has this intrinsic property. But you could think of that intrinsic property as just being these different components of the spinner field. Yeah.
I understand what you're saying with the up-down component. So what decides if an electron is spin up or spin down?
What decides?
Yeah.
It would be like sort of how you set up your system, right? You have this field and it's inside an experimental apparatus or something, and then it just that determines. So the potential that you put your field in determines what your wave function is going to be, right? And so that wave function can evolve in time. But basically, the wave function will tell you exactly what the component of the up and the component of the down is, right? And if you make a measurement, it'll just be the probability. Those things are related to the probability.
Okay.
Fine. Yeah.
Okay. Can we go on to the next question?
Yes.
Now you're going to go on to your next one, Michelle?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was quite theoretical. I don't know how well that worked.
You know what? I've never heard a description like that when I studied it originally, and that gave me a whole new visualization.
Yeah.
Of that.
Yeah. I think that's really a good way to do it, because people try to use that one. So the thing that I'm showing you now, so the next question was about the difference between special relativity and general relativity.
This is question 20 on your sheet, but
Sorry, Ian.
in like two ways. We have special relative SR for special relativity, and then the physical differences, and then like the mathematical differences. So special relativity, have you guys been maybe talking a little bit about it? So it's a theory about space-time and how to label events in space-time, and then how to, so if you have like an observer S and then some other observer S prime that's moving with a relative velocity relative to this guy, special relativity tells you that maybe there's some events A and B, something that are happening. And the idea is, okay, now how can we label these so that we can go back and forth between these two frames of reference and really understand physics that's going on, right? That's special relativity. But the thing, so this is all good, it's fine, and you probably learned how you can use the Lorentz transformations to go back and forth and stuff. But in the universe, there's always dynamics, there's always something happening, and so there's forces, right? And so there's, I guess, people talk about four forces being gravity, electricity, and magnetism, the weak force, strong force. So these are all forces that can, this guy is a, I don't know, some person. These forces can move him back and forth, move him around, right? And the idea is that produces accelerations, because a force through Newton's second law will produce an acceleration, basically. So special relativity can deal with that. A lot of people think that accelerator frames don't work in special relativity, but in fact, that's not true. You can still deal with accelerator frames. It's just that what happens is that you have to treat these accelerations as, there are these forces as something that is physically happening to you, right? So as long as you're an observer and you know that something is pushing you, okay, you have all the formulas are there to be able to deal with that, okay? But general relativity is slightly different. It's also a theory of space-time. But it's also a theory of gravity. And the idea is that, again, you have observers, but S and S prime, and you're trying to label events in the space, and you're trying to figure out how to go back and forth between the two. But the difference in general relativity is that gravity is not a force. Okay? Gravity is no longer a force. And to sort of replace gravity as not being a force, you have to allow for the fact that space-time is no longer flat. So space-time has to be curved. And then if you have a curved space-time, then you don't need to treat gravity as a force. And essentially gravity is just a result of the curvature of space-time. Okay? And so this is like one of Einstein's big revelations, and it really was what made him famous. To think that gravity cannot be a force. And the best way to think about it, I think, is there's a story about Einstein's apple. So Newton had an apple that fell on his head and made him think about gravity. And Einstein had a similar thing. I don't know if the story is true, but the story goes that Einstein's apple was actually not an apple, it was a painter. And he said, apparently he was reading this newspaper article about a painter who fell several stories to the ground and then survived. And in the article, the painter said that it was weird when I was falling down, it felt like I couldn't feel gravity. I felt like I was just floating, right? And then apparently that is what made us realize, well, maybe gravity is not a force. And the truth is that really we don't actually ever feel gravity. So if you were the painter who was thrown off the roof, you would start to fall. And gravity is acting on every part of your body in the same way. So basically, you're just like floating through the air. And you can't tell if somebody put an elevator around, or somebody put a box around you so you couldn't see out of it. You would think you were just floating in space, right? And then when you hit the ground, okay, all of a sudden you know, okay, something's happening to you.
But really, that's not gravity, right? Gravity is not what's stopping you, right? We're standing on the Earth, and it's not gravity that I'm feeling on my feet, right? It's actually the Earth pushing up on me, right? Because that's what's happening. The Earth is producing all kinds of forces that is keeping me stable, right? So really, you never actually feel gravity ever. So why do we need to treat it as a force? And that's what Einstein did. He figured out that he found a way to make it so that when you're free falling, it's just like if you're way out in space and there's in a spacesuit out far from any other forces. That's the same thing. So you're just traveling along straight lines of curved space. And that's the idea. So really, we're all on a curved space-time right now, according to Einstein's idea. And so that's physically the difference. And then mathematically, the way to treat curved space, mathematically, the difference is that in special relativity, do you guys talk about the invariant quantity? So like d tau is sort of like if you want to find a length in special relativity, it's c squared delta t squared a minus I plus delta x squared plus delta y squared. Is delta z squared? Oh, 3 minutes. Does that make sense?
We need
one dimension. But you can imagine the three dimensions. Yep. So this is just a normal three-dimensional length, right? And actually, let me just write this a slightly different way, okay? As a matrix equation. So you imagine having a vector, a four vector now, c delta t, and then delta x, delta y, delta z. And I'm going to multiply it by a weird sort of matrix. It looks like this. Okay, so I have a minus one here, and then one's in the diagonal. So it's basically like almost the identity matrix. Okay, and then have the same vector, but just transposed. Right. So if you do this matrix multiplication, you get exactly that formula. All right. So another way of writing it would be.
You probably don't want the minus sign in front of C.
Oh no, I don't. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So if you multiply it this way, and you get exactly this formula. And so just writing it a different way, we usually label them like this. Right. So this is the same equation. I've just called this that thing. I've called this thing, and I've called this that thing. It's the same. Well, these two are the same. They're just transposed. Or I could even write transposed. Okay. In general relativity. This is the same equation, okay? The difference is that g mu nu is no longer minus 1, 1, 1, 1. In general relativity, these zeros become functions of the matter of the universe. And these diagonal elements also. So in general relativity, you still have this quantity. The distance is measured in this using this formula, but this thing, This is called the metric, space-time, is actually a function of the matter in the universe. And so that's the main difference, is that in special relativity you have, mathematically, you have some implied here. And then the Einstein equations tell you how to calculate the components of this metric tensor based on the matter of the universe. So matter bends space-time, and then follows straight lines. Okay, does anyone have any questions?
So when you're dealing with the matter in the universe for that, is that just in the area that you're specifically looking at?
Or is it just like the whole universe?
Yeah, you have to talk with the matter of the whole universe. And, well, yes.
Sean, just regarding what you said earlier about it, it's like the Earth pulling us down, but the Earth is what's pushing us up,
preventing
us from feeling gravity. I always think that's like really a good way to figure out how the gravitational forces, in the sense of, you know, you have the whole damn Earth, right? All people, bugs, continents, and the core pulling down on us. And the only thing that prevents us from sinking into it is a few square inches of electromagnetic repulsion between the soles of the feet and down.
Yeah.
It kind of gives you a real case for how deep gravity really is.
Yeah.
That's true.
Okay. Round of applause for Sean, please. Now I'm going to turn it over to Drew Bansell, and he's going to come down and tell you a little bit about himself, and he's going to take a look at a couple of questions or three, I guess, or something like that.
Yeah, you got it.
Okay, so my name is Drew Pencil. I don't know. See, the thing is, okay, Damien wrote me into doing this yesterday, so you'll have to forgive me if it seems a little unpolished. And I don't think I'm going to so much like go through a list and tell you which questions you can answer. I'll just going to talk, and then maybe you'll figure out which questions I answer or didn't answer. that way I can seem like I know a lot more than I do. So about myself. Okay, so I was from the university. I graduated there in 2005, and I studied business and math. I wanted to be a physicist since I was a small boy. It's kind of a weird impulse for children in this age. But, so that was in 2005, and I went to graduate school immediately afterwards at the University of Texas at Austin. So if you're good with numbers, you will figure out 2006 minus 2005 is just 1 year of graduate school. Okay, so, you know, regards to this great dream of becoming a physicist one day, I'm actually kind of a rookie at this point. I don't really know very much. And so when I had this great opportunity to come here to the Perkins Institute, the question became, well, what do you do in research? And, you know, there's quantum gravity. That's what we're doing here, right? Kind of, it's a big thing. This is like a glorious edifice of human thought. It's, you know, quantum gravity is so beautiful. Maybe built on sort of unsolid foundations, perhaps, you know, depending on what your opinions are. But glorious nonetheless. And the problem with it is it's kind of demanding, you know, mathematically. I just don't have math. And the choice was, do I sit around at Printer for 2 months reading textbooks and smarting up, or do I try and actually do some research? So I went with the latter option. And I thought I'd let you know what I'm actually working on right now is trying to apply self-organizing principles to space and time. And that sounds very sort of new agey, right? But maybe it's a little bit more solid than it sounds. Maybe you can get a taste of it. A good example is the World Wide Web. Right, because what is this? You know, we all have web pages, or you know, many of us do, and you just put a bunch of links to other web pages, and it's your choice, you can do whatever you want, right? But as it turns out, if you analyze the entire structure of the whole World Wide Web, these patterns just sort of appear, and you know, where do they come from? I don't know. You find that statistically, the entire World Wide Web obeys equations, it obeys distributions that are indistinguishable from that of the relation between chemical reactions in a human cell, or that are indistinguishable from the sort of network of human social contacts or the spread of HIV in Sweden, according to one particular study. So this is really critical. You know, what does that mean? Is this like a deep pattern in the world? I have like a lot of little guys that are doing random things, whatever they want, but somehow there's like a law of large numbers working in the background that no matter what happened at the local level, I wind up with patterns, sort of organization, if I look at things from an appropriately global perspective. And you can think that, you know, that's just a coincidence, but I think it's deep. So I'm trying to apply these ideas to quantum gravity. The upshot, of course, is I don't need to know mesh representation theory to do that. So that's what I've been doing for the last 6 weeks, unsuccessfully, but that's what's been going on. Let me see. Is there anything else? Oh, I do want to say, I'm just disappointed to see my high school physics teacher, Paul Panov, is not actually here, which is disappointing. But I really think it's,
maybe next year.
I was, last night I was hoping maybe he'll show up, and I would show him whose boss he could be that maybe. I'm calling him and see who's got. Okay, so like I admitted to you just now, I know a lot of math, but I didn't be wrong, I don't know that much, so I understand that maybe seeing a lot of equations is not really the best way to get something. And if you want to explain this to your own students or your friends or, you know, impress girls at bars, whatever you do with physics, you don't want to use equations, right? You want to use nice pictures and stuff. So I'm going to try to do that. I'm going to try and draw a lot of pictures. I swear to God, there'll be an equation somewhere before I'm over. But let's just get started. Okay, well, it's going to be short.
There's a whole lot of string here.
We're all short. Great. All right, so I thought I'd start with maybe stars. Can we talk about stars, maybe? Does anybody know the rock band, the Mighty Giants? You know that song about the sun they sing? It's basically encapsulates everything I'm going to say, so if I might write in the first verse. The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace, where hydrogen is burned into helium at a temperature of billions of degrees. It goes on from there. But there's a lot. So this is a star. This is what it does, and this is its normal sequence, let's say. Or sorry, the main sequence, I believe. This is when it's burning hydrogen in its core to helium. How do they do that? Well, it's huge, right? Stars are big. And there's almost gravitational pressure, right? And the thing wants to contract. So its core heats up, and that gives us temperatures at which we can burn hydrogen into helium at a temperature of billions of degrees. And of course, this is counterbalanced by the gravitational attraction of the stars. So here's gravity. Maybe I put a big hat in here, fusion. And it's kind of cool, like, stars are like hearts, they beat, you know, because if your gravitational attraction becomes a little bit weaker, then all of a sudden the star will expand. Sorry, am I saying that right? Gravitational attraction becomes a little bit weaker, gravitational attraction becomes a little bit stronger, all of a sudden the star will shrink. But then temperature's going to get hotter here, and that's going to increase the rate of nuclear fusion, and it's going to create more pressure, so it goes out again. But then it'll expand to the point where it cools down a bit. Right? And then the fusion decreases and the gravitational part takes over. So the thing is just beating in space like this. It's kind of beautiful. Think about it. So what happens? Eventually it runs out of hydrogen and it gets even hotter and starts burning helium in its core and it blows up, becomes huge. This is my yet bigger star, the red giant. You know, you can imagine it's really big. And there's, you know, different kinds of fusion happening in here. And I'm sure you've all heard about this. There's a chain of different elements that get made in the center of stars. And I think one of the questions had something to do with that curve that we're all sort of familiar with. I should mention there's an interesting story here. So somehow here, helium is being made into all sorts of stuff. Carbon, oxygen, silicon, all these kinds of things. There's some weird little sort of anecdote here about Fred Hoyle and the Anthropic principle, which I don't think I really kind of get into that, but it's populated, I'll tell you about it. It's kind of interesting. But anyway, so this keeps going on for a long time, and then we all see this curve. And this is the atomic mass off bottom, and here is the binding energy per nucleon over here on the y-axis. And it kind of looks like this, with some weird bumps, and kind of tails off like that. And what's this peak? This is iron, right? This is iron 56. Somewhere out here is uranium 238. And hydrogen is way down here at the bottom. And so, of course, we're familiar with fusion. Like, you should look at this graph, and in some sense, it's saying, like, over here, I have the least energy, and energy kind of increases as I go down. That's not quite correct, but that's good enough way to do it. So I fuse two things, and move forward, because I get the bigger atomic mass, and I move up, so my energy decreases. So that's the process that I can do. And similarly for fission, not as good because the slope is much less, right? Just like fusion bombs do more damage than fission bombs do for energy, whatever. So once you're iron, you can't go anywhere from it, right? So once the core gets to be, you know, an iron core, it's going to keep shrinking and keep shrinking, and eventually it's going to turn into one of a few different types of star, depending on its initial mass and angular momentum and all that stuff. But stars are boring, right? What we really care about today is black holes. And I think one of the questions was, how does the angular momentum of a star manifest itself in the angular momentum of a black hole? Okay, and what I'm going to talk about is something called the membrane paradigm. That's a very pretentious way of saying that let's, you know, embrace our ignorance about black holes. Okay, there's this thing in the middle, it's this region that once you get to, you can never come back out of, right? All familiar with that notion of the imagination. So instead of pretending that, like, you know, this is really part of our space-time, let's just totally ignore it. Let's pretend that the black hole is just this surface. It's just like a membrane. And it really kind of is, right? Because it's got mass. The mass is membrane. This, you can think of it as, like, I don't know, a balloon or something if you want. The mass of this balloon is just equal to the mass of whatever is inside the black hole. We would usually interpret as the mass of the black hole. It's got mass, boom, there it is. And you can think of it as a conducting membrane, right? And if we remember the elementary electrostatics, it puts some charge on a conductor, it just redistributes itself in their very natural way. I don't need one number to describe the, I don't need one number, right, to describe the charge distribution of some charges on a conducting surface. So we've got some charge, Q. Similarly, for the mass, we can think of it as saying, well, let's pretend it's sort of elastic, okay? So if I put some mass on it, it's like you know, exactly like a balloon surface, and there's going to be a natural shape that's just assumed by it. So again, I only need the one number to distinguish what the mass of this membrane, i.e. this black hole, is. And then the only other thing that it turns out I can have for a black hole via some theorem is angular momentum complete all the way to the top. Of course, that's a bet, right? We can always choose some preferred direction, and we can just call it scalar. So it spins. It's got mass and charge, it's a spinning membrane, and it goes around like this. And the idea is, I want to convince you that you can really treat it as like a real object. What are the things that real objects have? They're hot, they have temperatures, right? Et cetera, et cetera. We'll talk about why the black hole has temperature and all this kind of stuff in a minute. But to answer the question of how we go from a big old red giant that's spinning with some angular velocity to how we get to this picture, it's a little bit more question, right? It's hard. I can't answer that question because nobody really can. We don't understand the details of the collapse yet. There's a lot of crazy things happening, right? That are very difficult to model. There's, like, you know, the convection currents of matter moving around inside the body of the star. If the star has a magnetic field, you can have solar wind that blows off particles everywhere. And as that wind blows away particles, the angular momentum is going to change. You can imagine as this thing is shrinking, it goes through stage of, you know, the white dwarf, or sorry. It goes through stage of the neutron star or whatever, all these intermediary quantum mechanically held up states. It's going to be very difficult for us to model. As it turns out, only in the last few years people have been able to even get a numerical handle on these things. And the analytical approach is just lacking. We don't know. We don't know how we get from here to here. But we do know that it must happen, right? Because, you know, physics, energy conservation, conservation of angular momentum. We know that if this guy starts out with an angular momentum, over there, the black hole's got to have it somehow, right? And as it turns out, even that statement is sort of suspect, because in general relativity, you don't necessarily have conservation of energy. It's not a guaranteed thing. You don't necessarily have conservation of angular momentum. These things are all contingent upon what we call what space-time looks like at asymptotic infinity. And that's a mouthful, right? But it's a very simple idea. Let's pretend the universe is just one star, right, at the origin. And if I go infinitely far away in some direction where I expect no curvature anymore, right? Because I'm so far away that the presence of the star doesn't really matter. So when I'm all the way out here at infinity, then, you know, things look just like normal space, right? And I can maybe talk about energy, and locally energy will be better, et cetera, et cetera. Because it turns out I have to use these ideas. So when I'm far away, define energy, define momentum, define angular momentum. And then maybe when I move in close to the star and start to measure how I'll find it there indeed, sir. Or maybe they're not. It depends. If I go far enough away to infinity and space is not just flat and normal like we know it to be, then there's no guarantee that this black hole needs to respect the angular momentum conservation law. Well, we reference the angular momentum, say, this. It's possible, for example, that if you're in a universe that's continuously expanding, like we suppose our universe to be, that in some sense energy is not conserved in a global sense. Because if I go infinitely far away from this black hole that's centered by expanding universe, things don't look like normal flat Minkowski space. If you recall that tensor that Sean wrote down, the -1 and 1s down there, that's like our normal nice space that we understand. It doesn't look like that ever. No matter how far away you get from mass distributions, you'll always have these weird functions floating around there, basically telling you your space is kind of expanding. It's like this membrane is being stretched. It's like some liquid that's being, you know, expanding or something like that. But so I can't really give you a solid explanation of this is how we get from this picture to this picture. And it's not even guaranteed that you ever can. But what I can say is there are a few analogies that you can think of. One that I really like is the kitchen sink example. You fill up your kitchen sink, pop the drain cover out, and start swirling, right? And you can think of a black hole as sort of a vortex in the middle of the kitchen sink. You can think of space-time as the water kind of swirling around it. And that's what's happening when a black hole is rotating. It really does that. It really drags space-time in circles around it. It's very strange. This is an effect that's known as frame dragging. I can sort of illustrate to you very crudely, I suppose, what I mean by this. And you can sort of visualize maybe doing this experiment in your kitchen sink in your home or whatever it is. Let's say I got a black hole right here, and he's spinning. Let's be kind of doing from the top, right? So I'm doing from the top of this diagram. He's spinning in this sense, right? So, you know, if you're looking at your kitchen sink, you expect the water to be spinning in this way. And indeed, space itself spins somehow around this black hole in a sense. If I take a little test particle, I set him up over here, and I shoot him off with this initial, you know, angular momentum, right? What's he going to do? It turns out he does something like this. What do you expect? It kind of goes around in a circle. And due to the mathematics of relativity, it's not as nice as Newtonian mechanics. It's not guaranteed that he's going to come back to his original position. But he will just keep executing large circles like this around the guy, something this sort. Now, what happens if I, you know, flip the orientation of this cell? It's kind of messed up. Let's get our black hole again. He's spinning in the same direction. Now, I'll start with a test pipe over here, and I'll shoot him on the opposite to the sense of rotation. And you can imagine if you do this in your kitchen sink and you give like, I don't know, rubber ducky or something, give him like a little kid, he's going to start moving in the direction that he went. Eventually, the fact that all that water is spinning is going to suck away his angular momentum and force him to turn around. That's exactly what happens with test particles. They eventually come here, they lose so much energy that they have to turn around and they start spiraling inward to the black hole. It's really strange. And you would think that space-time, and this really is supposedly a real effect. It's not some sort of mathematical construct. It's not just the coordinates that we've chosen. It's real, supposedly. And the gravity probe 2D is, I think, in space right now. Yeah. It's meant to be checking for this. I don't know how it does so, because it's here. But supposedly, it's doing this.
The
gyroscopes. That's right. I guess to see how the gyroscopes themselves are.
If you go around this way, if you go around this way, right, the precision will be different.
Okay. I want to hear your thoughts. Yes, this is very cool. You really think of space-time as a sort of real thing. There are philosophical objections to make that idea, but it's definitely a good analogy at least to work with. Let me see what else I want to say. Oh, right, black hole radiation. One of the cool things about studying black hole like this is let's look at this picture. Okay, if I, let's say something like black hole, right, gravity can be very strong, it's obviously getting pulled into it constantly. Let's say, you know, a bunch of gas comes in like this. What's it going to do? It's going to start spinning around. It's going to go like this. And then maybe some more gas, I'll be able to defend the solid line. Maybe some more gas will come in this way. It's spinning. Maybe it's supposed to be symmetric, right? Here comes one more. If you look at like some region where all these sort of three streams that I've drawn have crossed, they never crossed the stream, sure. But like over there, what you've got going on is that you have particles moving at tremendous velocities right past each other, and they're going to hook. They're going to have, you know, frictional contact. Friction produces heat. Heat produces light, right? That's radiation. So when you have this thing, this is called an accretion disk that surrounds a black hole. You're going to get light popping right out of this. And I'm sure you've seen a lot of those really like beautiful pictures that you get from Hubble. I'm not going to bother trying to render it with this piece of chalk. But it's like, you know, you see the little black hole in the middle and you can't, it's got no details. It's a very mysterious thing. It's like looking directly in the center of somebody's eye. And around it is a beautiful iris in a very similar fashion. It's that gorgeous accretion disk that's heated up to be so incredibly strong. It's like one of the brightest sources of light in the universe, you know? Off the top of my head, it's not true, but I believe this is like one of the reasons that you can actually see galaxies so far away. It's not just that their stars are so bright, it's actually like those accretion disks in the middle that surround the supermassive black holes at the center of many galaxies are just so bright. And a little tidbit I picked up today from Wikipedia, apparently, this is an incredibly, incredibly efficient way of generating energy. Like, eventually this mass will spiral into the black hole, right, and eventually disappear from our universe. But about 50% of its mass energy gets converted to radiation during this process of accretion and diffusion of radiation. That's way better than fusion, which is just, you know, fiddling 2 or 3%. So I think, you know, NSF, we got fun with your black hole power plants, throwing garbage, and they'll heat up, and we'll have, you know, unlimited free energy.
But when the black hole gets bigger, then you've got a problem.
Obviously, we're going to talk about the black hole evaporates in a little bit. So it's perfect. Okay, so now, through the magic of dimensional analysis, maybe not quite magical, let's see. So this is one way the black holes radiate, and this is very bright. Like, I'm going to talk right now about another mechanism that's talking radiation, by which they also radiate light, but this is like nothing in comparison. Though it's kind of a more interesting phenomenon. This is very classical by nature, right? This is just stuff hitting stuff. And friction, you know, there's no cushion is totally elastic, right? Things are, you know, friction happens, you get heat, you get light. This is all very classical. Now I'll start with not classical, right? This is quantum mechanics. So I have to, okay, let me give you, because I didn't want to bother you guys with pies and speed of lights and all my formulas, so let's just, I'm going to ignore all that stuff, but to motivate, I'm going to try and get it. This is another cool little physics lore thing. What's the formula for the period of the pendulum length L?
2 pi, right?
I totally recited right. It's like minus b plus minus square root of b squared. It's one of those formulas everybody knows, right? So here we go. This is what we know it is. This is the period of some pendulum. Did you ever hear that dimensional analysis? How do you derive this? One way to do it, right, is to write down Newton's laws, the equations of motion, solve the differential equation doing a Taylor series about that equilibrium point at the bottom. It's a mess. Let's not do it that way. Let's just guess what it should be, right? This sounds like, you know, this is one of those things when you first see it, like, oh my god, you know, I can do this, it's so easy. So all you do is you say, okay, I got a pendulum, here it is, what are the numbers that matter? This, and then there's the force of gravity, right? This is completely describing the pendulum, at least in the idealized case, right? Oh, there's another good physics for it. But it turns out this number doesn't matter in the period, right? We all know that, because we all know the formula. But, you know, where did it come from? Galileo, I believe, somewhere in some Italian church in the High Renaissance, is like four, right? He's sitting there in the pew, and he notices that all the pendulums are swinging, and their period, at least with the smallest churches, right? Notice how that pillar series expansion doesn't depend on how big or beautiful or splendor of the chandelier that happens to be hanging. It's IP. It doesn't depend on this mass. One of the cool bits of physics lore is how do you figure this out that it's independent of the mass? Well, we look at the swinging of the pendulums and the, look at his pulse, right? And he counted the number of heartbeats between each period. And that's how he was able to figure out that the time is the same. And of course, once he invents the clock, he uses the clock to measure his own heartbeats to conclude that the period is the same. So it's sort of this good circular reasoning here. You think that in some sense we don't. So it's one of those things about how you really measure time, what you really mean when you're saying something lasts for as long as it's periodic or it's regular. It's strange. And there's a lot of relativity hidden in sort of assumptions like this. But anyway, okay, so this number doesn't matter, right? We don't need it. And what about L and G? So if it's longer, right, the period is going to be longer, right? We already know that. So let's say the period looks like, I'll put a little proportionality thing in here. It looks definitely depend on L. What about G? If gravity is super, super strong, then the period is just going to be naturally small, right? So G should be in the bottom. That if G goes to infinity, this goes to zero. If L goes to infinity, this goes to infinity. That's good. What are the units of this thing? This is meters. This is one of these meters per second squared. Right? So this is second squared. It's all throwing square root. Oh, we might have time. And I pretty much got a formula too, right? All I'm missing is 2 pi. We don't care about numbers. Who cares? So that's I just solved the problem. That's full credit. On my exam,
like, anyway, so I'm
going to talk about is thought creation. I'm going to try to use this philosophy. I hope you'll excuse my not being any constant, because we're basically doing something very similar. So let's talk about a black hole for a second. Now, if you know your field theory, which I don't, you'll understand that, you know, here's a photon propagating along somewhere, and it has a probability to just turn magically into an electron and a positron, you know, call it E minus and E plus, right? Mm-hmm. And then they combine again, and they turn back into phone. And it goes, this happens all the time, constantly, right? Everywhere. And it's some, there's a lot of cool things you can say, like this leads to stuff, and there's lots of math you can do. But for our purposes, we don't need to know any of that. All we need to know is this is happening constantly right now in this room, right? So what happens if this happens near the event horizon? We know that if something crosses this line, it's gone forever, right? It'll never ever come back. It's gone. So, you know, let's set up the whole situation. Here's my photon. And all of a sudden it splits. And boom, there goes the electron. And maybe the positron shoots off this direction. Oh crap, you know, it's crossed the line. It's never gonna come back. So what does this look like? This electron no longer needs to annihilate anymore. But this is bad, right? Because we just created a charge. We just created a bit of mass. This is like really bad. So, of course, you know, I hope you believe, I hope you, you know, understand this situation, but you also understand this complete bogus. Something has to come out of the black hole in order to cancel this problem. Well, comes that little positron shoots out. There he is. Okay, now no problems. Charge is conserved, that's okay, but we still have a problem with the mass, right? We've doubled the mass problem. These guys have the same mass. Well, yeah, what's going to happen? And it turns out you just have to decrease the mass of the black hole a little bit. That's the only way to really account for this kind of stuff. So then the event horizon has to shrink a little bit. Because remember, I don't know if this has come up, but the radius of that membrane, right, when we think of the black hole's membrane. And maybe if you think of it as a membrane, it's a little bit easier, you know? Like if the electron comes away, maybe it pulls off like your positron from an uncharged conducting black hole membrane, however you want to think that. Remember that the radius of one of these black holes is, let's ignore all constants like 2 and the gravitational constant, it's its mass, right? It's 2gm if you want to be, 2gm or c squared if you want to be precise, but it's its mass. And so if its radius is up, if its mass decreases, its radius is about to decrease a little bit. Right? So all this means
how has its mass decreased if it's already absorbed a positron and stopped then? Because it's gained one of the positrons.
This is one of those weird things where like these aren't like fueled particles in some sense. I'm not too clear on the specifics. Sean is probably a better person to ask what's the difference. I'm sorry to put you on the spot like that, but
thank you all.
I don't know the answer to that question. It's a good question. I don't know the answer.
We can. Is that like one mass shell and all?
Yeah, it has something to do with like virtual particles and
all mass shells.
Whenever I hear an explanation, that's like bullshit. You know? I'm sure that's like, you know, it's not a problem. It's not a mass shell. Great. But yeah, okay, so for some reason, it's a problem.
Okay.
But then, again, you know, the, this is like.
Because it's also what's happening when it's not quite as simple as the.
Yeah.
I can hear about that. Right, so I'm trying to think of a way to intuitively explain that, but I can't.
I researched for a long time. This is the best and simplest explanation I can come up with, unless you want to start doing unreal tech or SDAs or whatever, but this is the best I can. Let's just do it.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's lighter.
Yeah, it's lighter. So anyway, so because much, you know what? I think maybe a good way to think about it is that instead of absorbing this, you can think of, it has to have created two particles. And one of them had to go in. And because from our point of view, this looks like an electron and positron popped out of the membrane. And even though you could interpret it as, well, okay, one electron popped out of the vacuum, and then a positron went in, and another guy went out, we don't know that this really happened. Right? In some sense, there's a sort of a gloss, you can't observe stuff like this ever actually happening, except in weird situations. So from our point of view, it just looks like two guys popped out of the membrane. And so the memory is that it's just mass.
So you didn't just lose the mass of the positron, you lost the mass of both.
Yeah, in some sense. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly the numbers, but anyway, we're ignoring numbers like 2.
Well, okay. As long as the positron is popping out, is having a higher kinetic energy, then it's fine.
I guess, I mean, yeah, but a lot of ways to muck it out with this. I mean, you also might say, I mean, if these are both created here, gravity is so strong, the wire, they both immediately just suck in. The black hole grows bigger, but then if it grows bigger, where did that extra mass come from? There are all these other problems you can come up with. But I think fundamentally it has to do with the fact that I don't really understand it.
And this point is off the mass shell.
Yeah.
And it's some concern.
Do you know what that means?
That's what I said.
But okay, so this is happening all the time. Yeah, this is some mechanism by which black holes can decrease their mass. Can you think about it? What's going on here? It looks like that membrane, which we've already characterized as having mass, it's got a charge, it's a distributed because it's a convector. You know, and it's got some angular momentum. Now it's a temperature. Why is it a temperature? Because stuff's popping out of it, right? I had radiation coming off this thing. So it's like if I actually touch it, it would be hot. Well, not actually hot. We're going to find the temperatures like vanishingly small later on. But yeah, if we touch it, we have a temperature, right? And so you can actually calculate if you receive them off. You want to make a better view of your life. You can calculate the temperature of a black hole. Looks like this. It's one over its mass. I'm ignoring such numbers as pi and the gravitational constant. Actually, it might be useful to just get a tally of what numbers should be appearing in these formulas that I'm lacking. Okay? What's important?
C
is important, right? The speed of light, because here was a photon. Somewhere a photon's involved, so the speed of light's got to appear. What else?
Big G,
right. I'm talking about black holes. They're governed by its strength of gravity. What else?
And little m, mass and photon, or?
Possibly, but as it turns out, I think, I don't know if that one ever shows up. Because I think you could write about it in terms of just the light, because of the energy spectrum.
Planck's constant?
That's one, right? That's going to be governed by Planck's constant. And
a pi?
Yeah, there's definitely a pi. For sure. Pi is exactly one. I think there's a six. somewhere in here, these constants are floating around. Let's ignore it. All that's important is the temperature is proportional to one over the mass. And I don't know statistical mechanics, right? But if that's something like a temperature, how much calories are radiated each second? Goes in as temperature of fourth, right? And there's a bunch of things. Sigma, there's something else in here, but we're going to ignore all that crap, right? All we care about is that it's going to be area times temperature of fourth. This should remind you, right? And we already know what temperature is. What's area like the black hole? 4 pi r squared, right? And r is the mass, and we're going to figure it out now. So this looks like 4 pi is equal to 1. So we have mass squared, that's the area, and our temperature is 1 over the mass to the fourth. We find that this is actually 1 over the mass squared, right? But what's power? Power is energy per time. Right? And you know, energy is the same thing as mass, right? So this is really mass per time. So I can write this as dm dt. Really, I should put a minus sign here because this is power that's being lost, not absorbed. So there's a minus sign. So what does this tell me? This tells me the mass. I have a differential equation, right? For unless I can write something like, I would expect that my differential equation looks something like, the mass is a function of time is over here. The mass is a function of time. It should be like there's a constant, and then, there we go. And it decreases like that, right? Where this is something I'm going to get just by integrating this guy. And if I have this, I can actually figure out when this derivative equals the initial mass of my black hole, right? And I can measure the lifetime of the black hole. Right? And say, given that a black hole has this mass, it's going to be radiating at its temperature, and that's going to decrease its mass. That's going to change the way it radiates. That's okay. I can write that down. That's my differential equation right here. I can combine all this information to give me a measure of the lifetime of a black hole. So the lifetime of a black hole over mass m roughly looks like its mass q. This is kind of an interesting result. But let's get some numbers in here, okay? So I wrote these things down. Let's see, the mass of the sun, maybe I can do this here. So the sun, there's some comparisons. Okay, mass of the sun, again, universe. The mass of the sun is roughly 2 times 10 to the 30th. This is in kilograms. Okay? As it turns out, this temperature is all much guess. We don't have any constants in here, so you have no notion of scale, but.
Like the temperature of a
black hole. I'm sorry, you actually say it's the temperature of a black hole with mass of our sun. It's not our actual sun.
4 Kelvin.
It's 4 Kelvin. That's a pretty good guess for the moon, as it turns out. The sun is 60 times 10 to the negative 9 Kelvin. This is a nano Kelvin. That's like the smallest possible temperature. What does that even mean? Like the cosmic microwave background is 9 orders of magnitude hotter, right, than this guy. It's kind of amazing. As it turns out, as the mass increases, the temperature decreases, right? And the lifetime increases. So this black hole, the size of the sun, would last for 10 to 67 years. Right? That's way longer than the age of the universe so far. It's 40 orders of magnitude or something like that, right? So it sort of makes sense that this is fundamentally a quantum mechanical result. Right? I mean, black holes are a stable object in relativity theory, right? And the black hole just sits there doing nothing. And we figured out the black holes are possible somewhere around 1920-ish.
And this result only came out somewhere around like the 80s or 90s, I don't remember. So we had a good 60 years right there where if black holes this size were, you know, just evaporating like that, we would have noticed it. I mean, there are a lot of candidate black holes out there in the collagens that we've seen, and we would, you know, see them tweaking off every now and again, right? So, okay, so that tells you that this effect is very, very small. It's a quantum mechanical effect. But let's look at the moon, just for comparison. You get a sense of how you can scale. The moon's mass is, roughly 4 times 10 to the 22nd kilograms. And its temperature, again, good guess, is 2.7 K. That's right around the temperature of the microwave, that way. And its lifetime is actually quite long, too. It's about 3 billion years. Okay. So it makes sense that probably most black holes we see are huge, right? They're like the supermassive ones or something like that. They're going to last forever, but we don't notice Hawking radiation. What we do see is massive amounts of accretion radiation, right? That classical piece. We don't see the quantum mechanical one. But then, of course, the question here is like that. So what if that really tiny black hole, sort of primordial one, and what, something like that? Maybe particles are black holes because, you know, particles have mass and charge and spin angular momentum or something like that. There's all sorts of crazy, you know, speculations that you can make now. You've got some cool little theory. But of course, you know, this might all be totally bogus because we don't know what quantum gravity is. This is a result of quantum gravity, right? That is by quantum mechanics to gravitational problem. How do I really know that it's gravity? Yeah, please go ahead.
Oh, you said only 50% of the mass approximately is converted to energy in the accretion disk, so what about the other mass that's being added?
It gets absorbed in the black hole, and the black hole is growing in size.
So then if the black hole is growing in size, then isn't that adding?
This is completely classical, right? This is before we know that black holes can shrink. I mean, it was always just assumed that black holes are just going to have to get bigger and bigger and bigger because it's going to keep swallowing stuff. But this is a mechanism by which black holes can get smaller. Admittedly, it's not a very good mechanism.
So once it's no longer absorbing mass,
I'm just saying it can be evaporating as it's sucking mass.
Yeah, that's right. It's continuing to evaporate.
Yeah. But at such a small rate.
Which is why that this result is theoretically of interest. But in terms of mass, this is looking for Hawking radiation from black holes, and we'll find it. This is still the dominant effect. But, I think it's kind of all I really have to say, but I hope you kind of hope you got a good idea.
So you reckon you're going to say something about miniature black holes?
No, I wasn't. Oh. Don't worry about it, but people can do stuff with them. I know there's lots of cool things that you can say, but I don't know if that
will be done. Just to stay on topic, if you've got any questions for Drew or Sean, and maybe you could spare a few minutes after the afterwards, that'd be great. A round of applause for Drew. Short break?
Yeah.
About 10 minutes?
10 to 15 minutes.
10 to 15 minutes. Oh.